Joining me in the studio, as usual, is our resident expert, David Miller. David's an academic and a former professor at Bristol University, and is now a non-resident senior research fellow at the Centre for Islam and Global Affairs at Istanbul Zeyim University. He's also a co-director of the lobbying watchdog Spinwatch, and is a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. Joining us again as our guest contributor today is Amar Kazmi. Amar is an anti-imperialist political activist and a commentator. He previously worked on Jeremy Corbyn's 2016 leadership campaign and was a political advisor in my parliamentary office from 2017 to 2019. Welcome to the show. David, you know, the Tifa's report there showed that Chabad is deeply embedded in the genocide being conducted by the Zionist entity. I mean, does that strike you as odd for a group that used to be anti-Zionist?
Well, this is an anti-Zionist group which was always really pro-Zionist. It's a curious thing. So, although it was formally anti-Zionist up until 1967, it was only after 1967 they formally made their kind of peace with Zionism. But back in 1929 in Hebron, they actually stored Haganah weapons in the bank belonging to one of the Hamad followers, and they were engaged in spying on the local Palestinians and passing the information over to the nascent Mossad, you know, prior to the creation of the State of Israel. So they've been anti-Zionists who have been collaborating with and using Zionism in order to further the settlement activities which they approved of.
Yeah. Well, Amar, I mean, this group calling for the recolonization of Gaza, I mean, it appears to be ultra-Zionist, doesn't it?
Well, certainly, and David just ran through some of the history there. I mean, they did formally at one point oppose the creation of the State of Israel, but this is a thoroughly ultra-Zionist sect. I mean, they believe, Zionism is so fanatical that they believe that the current Israeli state has no real authority against them. They oppose any sort of peace deals. And in the most recent offensive on Gaza, the genocide that's been perpetrated against Gaza, they've had the audacity to set up a Chabad house in the Gaza Strip in December of last year. So this is a thoroughly pro-Zionist organization that's deeply involved and embedded in not just supporting it in terms of words and in terms of ideology, but also materially in terms of fundraising and lobbying.
Well, David, I mean, obviously you've touched on this already, but I just wonder whether you could perhaps explain how this group, along with many other Hasidic groups, I mean, used to be anti-Zionist.
Well, if you listen to Natura Carta, which is the militant anti-Zionist Hasidic group, they say routinely, if you listen to their talks, in 1947, the chief rabbi of Jerusalem said we should not have a Jewish state. And that was the position of almost all the Hasidic sects at the time. Mm. Now, what's happened since then is that they've made their peace with the Zionists. Now, in the case of Chabad, for example, they have a written agreement with the IDF that when they join the IDF, that 25% of the guys who join the IDF can go off to yeshivas for a year, maybe in New York or somewhere, one of their other worldwide offices. Whereas some of the other Hasidic groups are still sufficiently anti-Zionist that they refuse to allow their children, when they reach 18, to serve in the IDF. But nevertheless, and so there's an ongoing process there where the IDF are trying to encourage them to join. And they have, throughout the West Bank and the illegal settlements, they have these what are known as IDF yeshivas, where they're allowed to go and do Torah study, and then they also have to go and kill a few Palestinians on the weekend. So it's that kind of arrangement. And that's how it works. And that's what's compromised almost all of the Hasidic sects now. There's only one, the Satmar, which is quite a large one, which remains formally anti-Zionist. Mm. But it's been a process from really the 1930s to today of compromising that anti-Zionism and bringing the kind of ultra-Zionism of the Hasidic sects into the service of the Zionist entity.
Amar, Latifa mentioned in the report there about the so-called price tag attacks, which are associated with this group. I mean, just say a word or two about that, will you?
Well, these price tag attacks are essentially revenge attacks against Palestinians who are involved or perceived to have been involved in acts of resistance against the Zionist regime. We often hear in the West that these are these extremist settlers acting sort of their own volition, but actually they act as an extension of the Israeli regime, as militias for them. They're essentially completely unaccountable. They have total impunity. Often they're actually aided and abetted by the IDF in the West Bank. And the Israeli intelligence agency Shin Bet has said that the vast majority of these people involved in these attacks are linked to this extremist faction based in the Yitzhar settlement in particular. There's actually a Chabad-linked yeshiva, a Jewish seminary, in that settlement. So we see that it's really these individuals who are involved in it, but of course they're completely supported by the Israeli regime.
Mm. And David, what about this King's Torah's justification for killing Palestinian babies? What's that about?
Well, I mean, when you read this for the first time, you sort of you think, can this be true? But when you look back at it, you know, their actual main theological tome, the Tanya, describes Gentiles as being having husks for souls, and they have animal souls, they're not fully human. And of course, you know, it's a small step from deciding that to say, well, actually, in that case, you can kill children who are not Jewish. And in the case of Palestinians, the key question is, will they grow up to challenge us in the future? Of course, something which you can't tell about a baby, but nevertheless, they can tell, and they can tell that any Palestinian baby is a threat to them in the future, and they can be engaged regardless of whether you're trying to kill their parents or not. You can just kill the babies by themselves. And this is the depth of the horror of the philosophy and the ideas of this sect. And of course, we see that enacted every day in Gaza today and tomorrow and yesterday, and that's what's been going on here. This is the ideological justification for the direct killing and assassination, sometimes we've seen through by Israeli snipers, direct shots through the head of children, and this is the ideological justification.
Yeah, incredible. Well, Amar, I mean, Netanyahu has been a prominent and very long-term presence in the Zionist power structure. I mean, just say a little, will you, though, about his connection with the Chabad?
Well, you know, if you look at Netanyahu and his sort of family background, it's quite clear that he has a very long-term connection with sort of, you know, the revisionist Zionist movement in general. His father was an aide to Jabotinsky. Mm. After Jabotinsky died, you know, Netanyahu's father continued to work on the revisionist Zionist movement. You know, in a hostage recovery raid in the 1970s, Netanyahu was injured. His brother Jonathan was killed, and afterwards, Netanyahu set up an institute called the Jonathan Foundation, or the Jonathan Institute, which helps to research, you know, so-called terrorism, and helped to sort of give birth in the mid 1980s to this idea of Islamic terrorism,
right.
And you know, so in terms of promoting these sorts of ideas and being associated with Zionist extremism and also being associated with Chabad, this is something that Netanyahu has been associated with for many, many decades.
Right. Well, we'll come back to the discussion in a moment after our second report, which looks at the worldwide distribution of Chabad offices, its links to literal Nazis, and its deplorable fundraising activities.
In December, it was revealed that a Chabad group in the UK was fundraising to support the genocide in Gaza. Rabbi Aryeh Sufrin of Chabad claimed back in October that Hamas is worse than ISIS, in full conformity with Zionist entity talking points. He also disclosed that his son is a British recruit to the occupation forces and was in Occupy Palestine at the time. The Chabad appeal read, vital equipment needed by the IDF. Funds raised will go direct to equipment needed by Aaron Dov Sufrin's reserve unit up in the north of Israel and support units. Aaron Dov Sufrin is, of course, the son of the rabbi, serving actively in the genocidal occupation forces. Chabad Lubavitch is an ultra-Orthodox Hasidic sect which also happens to be a genocidal cult. It originates in Lubavitchy in Russia near the border with Belarus. It's a global movement with more than 5,000 offices in over 100 countries and in all 50 states of the US. It even has offices in seemingly unlikely places like China, Belarus, Tunisia, Morocco, and Venezuela. It has prominent supporters in many places. The new Argentinian president is a Chabad devotee. Donald Trump even donated to Chabad, though not as much as his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, who has played a pivotal role in the normalization of the Zionist entity. Obviously, Chabad has been highly organized in Ukraine, and Chabad followers were amongst those recruited in the Nazi Azov Battalion, which we should remember was co-founded by a former member of the Israeli occupation forces. Palestine Declassified previously reported on how Ukrainian Jewish oligarch Igor Kolomoisky bankrolled Chabad in Ukraine, as well as the Nazi Azov and Ida battalions. Back in the UK, there are more than 100 Chabad groups or offices. It flies under the radar and is widely regarded as well-meaning, if a little eccentric. In reality, it is an extremist group which is building support for genocide in the UK. Ironically, the Community Security Trust has aided Chabad, giving them security advice after an edition of Palestine Declassified exposed some of their activities. The CST has educating about extremism as one of its charitable objectives, but it is unwilling to educate us about the extremism of Chabad. There's a very good reason for that. Gerald Ronson, which created and runs the CST, is himself an extremist and has been supporting Chabad for more than half a century. Here he is in 2013 as a guest of honour at one of their events.
Chabad Lubavitch UK Ambassador's Award presented to Gerald Ronson CBE and Dame Gail Ronson for their friendship and support over four decades.
Zionist extremists are widely distributed in the UK and form a mutually supportive network. This is a key element of the justification and support for genocide in the UK.
Amar, I suspect a lot of people in this country would be absolutely shocked that a British Chabad group is raising funds for the Zionist occupation forces. I mean, a British Chabad group is doing that. I mean, that's incredible, isn't it?
Well, I mean, people, I think, would be shocked to find out that this organization has, you know, roughly around 100 branches across the entirety of the UK, has 1,000 branches in the United States, at least one in every single state, has, I think, about 5,000 branches worldwide. This is an incredibly large organization that wields a significant amount of power in terms of its lobbying capacities and its fundraising capacities. And it's really never spoken about publicly, despite the amount of influence that it has. And, of course, it poses as this very innocent, you know, well-meaning organization. But then we see that it's raising funds for the Israel occupation forces. It's 100% ideologically behind the genocide against the people of Gaza. As we heard earlier in the program, you know, that we have statements saying that it's legitimate to kill Palestinian babies. I mean, I think if people in Britain actually understood what this organization was, the sort of depth that it has in Britain, they'd be deeply, deeply shocked.
Well, it's certainly got some reach, hasn't it, David? I mean, in 100 countries. But I was pleased to say that I don't believe they've got any base in Cuba. I mean, is that right?
Well, I mean, it's interesting. There are bases in Venezuela, in revolutionary Venezuela. They have branches in Beijing and Shanghai and other places in China. Many branches in Russia, too, as you perhaps wouldn't expect. In Cuba, there isn't an official base there, but they do have a foothold. They have a follower there who acts as if they are a Chabad house in Havana, but they haven't formally got an office there. That's because, of course, the Communist Party has not allowed that, which is a good thing too. But they have spread over 100 countries. I mean, it's truly extraordinary. That's many more countries than have a formal Zionist presence by the Zionist movement itself, which is around about 35 or 40 countries. But nevertheless, this is an ultra-Zionist group spreading ultra-Zionist messages all around 100 countries. It's a truly extraordinary reach for an organisation, and it flies so far under the radar that hardly anyone's even heard of it.
Well, hopefully we hope to shed a bit of light on them. But Amar, I mean, wonder what you could say a word or two about Jared Kushner and his role in the normalisation process.
Yes, I mean, Jared Kushner, firstly, is someone who is very close to Chabad. He's personally donated thousands of dollars to Chabad, and during the Trump regime, he was given this sort of informal role to promote normalisation in the Gulf. We saw him as a very prominent public figure in the so-called Abraham Accords in 2020, in which Bahrain and the United Arab Emirates formalized publicly the sort of diplomatic relationship they'd already been secretly having with Israel, but formally normalized with Israel. And Kushner was very involved in that, also in Morocco, and of course as well in terms of lobbying the Saudi oligarchy, which was very close to reaching a normalization agreement with Israel before the events of the 7th of October last year. And, you know, after leaving the White House, I believe a hedge fund associated with him received $2 billion US dollars. Wow. From the Saudi Arabian Sovereign Wealth Fund. So this is someone who's been deeply involved in that process and is closely linked to Chabad. Yeah.
Well, I mean, another sort of extraordinary revelation relating to this organisation, David, is that a number of them have apparently signed up to fight in the Nazi Azov battalion in Ukraine. I mean, can that really be true?
Well, I'm afraid it is true, Chris. I mean, the thing that you've got to understand about Chabad in Ukraine is that in the UK and in the US, there's an official Zionist movement, and then there's Chabad. And the official Zionist movement mainly runs the organised Jewish community. In Ukraine, the organised Jewish community is mainly run by Chabad. And that's true, actually, also in Russia. And so what you see is that when Kolomoisky, the oligarch, the Ukrainian oligarch, who I think we can talk about a little bit later, when he is involved in funding something like Chabad, he's also involved in funding Azov and the IDR battalions. And what you see then is that you saw in the film that there are photographs from Zionist papers of Chabad followers joining up to fight the Russians. And of course, some of these are joining up with the Azov battalion. Incredible.
Well, it is incredible. I mean, and I wonder what you make of that, Amar. I mean, David mentioned there that Igor Kolomoisky involved in funding the Azov battalion and a huge Chabad community in Dnipro as well. I mean, this is amazing, isn't it?
Yes. Well, I mean, you know, Kolomoisky is, of course, is fantastically rich oligarch. Maybe not so much anymore after being sanctioned and having some of his funds taken away from him in London as well. You know, but he's this rich oligarch with Cypriot Israeli citizenship. And after the 2014 Maidan coup in Ukraine, he was given control of the Dnipro Oblast, which is, you know, a very strategically important region in southeastern Ukraine. And he helped to develop and create several armed militias. He helped to support, as we just heard, financially, the Nazi-linked or neo-Nazi, you could even say ideologically, Azov and ADA battalions.
Yeah.
And, you know, as well as that, he's also helped to fund Chabad extensively, helped to fund a Chabad Jewish community center, which is said to be the largest in the world. This is a deeply nefarious figure, deeply corrupt individual. You know, he is actually wanted by the U.S. Justice Department. He and his family can't travel there. He was actually put in pre-trial detention in Ukraine very recently on charges of money laundering and fraud. So this is someone who's used his wealth, got it in nefarious ways potentially, and has used it to help support this movement.
Another interesting funder, David, of course, is Gerald Ronson, isn't it? I mean, the guy who runs the Zionist Community Security Trust, which, you know, is adjacent to or works with Mossad. I mean, this is the organisation that claims that anti-Semitism is skyrocketing. I mean, what do you make of all that?
So their most recent report on the skyrocketing nature of anti-Semitism, you know, of course, counts people shouting Free Palestine as being an indication of anti-Semitism, shows the utter bankruptcy of their research. But we should also be looking much more closely at Ronson's charitable ventures, which of course have been involved for more than 50 years now in supporting Chabad, this extremist group. The CST says in its charitable objectives that it's supposed to educate the public about extremism, but they won't be doing any educating at all about Chabad, because they don't regard the extremism of Chabad as being extremism at all. And that indicates the deep rot at the heart of the CST, an organisation which gets some 15 million a year from the Home Office, and I think he's also got an extra 3 million on top after October the 7th from our dearly departed Home Secretary Suella Braverman. So this is a deeply, deeply corrupt organisation engaged in promoting effectively anti-Palestinian racism on a daily basis.
I mean, and you know, Gerald Ronson's involvement is rather curious, to say the least, isn't it? I mean, I mean, it's
Look, I mean, this is the guy who was, remember, he was put in jail for fraud, yes, as part of the Guinness fraud scandal, and he in his autobiography he bangs on about radical Islam and all various Islamophobic stuff in his book, and this is an organisation we're supposed to, the public is supposed to trust in dealing with anti-Semitism.
Yes, indeed. Well, I'm afraid we are out of time again, so let me thank our guest Amar Kazmi and, of course, our resident expert Professor David Miller. Palestine Declassified will be back next week with more forensic investigations and analysis. So until next time, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamate is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, Assalamu Alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. Very welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. Stay tuned.
چقدر شیرینه، چقدر امید بخشه که آدم بفهمه.
How beautiful and sweet it is when we understand that Imam al-Mahdi is supporting his people from behind the scene of the invisible world. I swear by Allah that if it was not because of the supporting hands of Imam al-Mahdi, the whole of Islam and especially Shia population would be wiped out of the scene of the world.
فقط یه حمله مغول تو قرن هفتم کافی بود که کلکش یه کنده بشه بره. تازه
One instance during the history was the attacks of Mongols and Crusaders on Islamic Persia in the 7th century Hijra. They attacked the Muslim lands, including Persians, in order to cut the roots of Islam from the region. They were successful in overcoming the Abbasid dynasty, but they could never erase the Shia legacy. This was because of the help and protection of Imam al-Mahdi that the Shia teachings remained intact, and still today he is of help to his pure followers and companions. As the famous sentence says, Imam al-Mahdi for Shias is like a sun behind the clouds. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech. which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. To find out more about this program, log on to our website parstoday.ir Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
Puzzle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure. IRIB English Radio.
The United Nations Special Rapporteur has said Israel is in breach of orders by the International Court of Justice regarding Gaza, citing lack of medical supplies, food and clean water, and continued demolition of infrastructure in the territory. Also, the Israeli regime Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has ordered a plan for ground invasion of densely populated Rafah in southern Gaza. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. The Israeli regime appears to be in breach of the orders issued a fortnight ago by the International Court of Justice, the ICJ, requiring it to take immediate steps to protect Palestinians' rights and cease all activities that could constitute genocide. The United Nations Special Rapporteur on the Occupied Palestinian Territories, Francesca Albanese, has said. The Israeli government was given until 23rd of February to report to the International Court of Justice on what it has done to comply with six orders the court issued, including one relating to ending incitement to genocide, and another court order requiring immediate steps to improve the supply of humanitarian aid in Gaza. Senior Western officials say that despite hours of negotiations with Israeli officials, there is at best a marginal and incremental improvement since the 26th of January ruling by the ICJ. Safe to say, it's dire and getting worse, one said. The International Court of Justice did not direct Israel to announce a ceasefire in Gaza, as South Africa had requested. But, by very large majorities, the judges did make orders that were intended to have practical effect. First, the Israeli regime was required to take all measures within its power to prevent and punish the direct and public incitement to commit genocide in relation to Palestinians of Gaza. After the court found discernible genocidal and dehumanizing rhetoric coming from senior Israeli government officials. Second, the International Court of Justice required Israel to take immediate and effective measures to enable the provision of urgently needed basic services and humanitarian assistance in Gaza. Israel was further required to take all measures within its power to prevent within the scope of the Genocide Convention, the killing of Palestinians, causing them serious bodily harm or mental harm, inflicting conditions of life calculated to bring about its physical destruction in whole or in part, and imposing measures intended to prevent births. Many lawyers have interpreted this to mean that the acts mentioned are not prohibited so long as Israel undertakes them without genocidal intent, which Israel says is the case and which the court will not test in full until later. Francesca Albanese, however, said she disagreed and that the International Court of Justice had mandated Israel to cease all activities that could constitute genocide. Despite this, she said, the violence and the demolition of civilian infrastructure had continued in Gaza, aggravating the harsh living conditions in that territory. The fatalities are not solely the result of bombings and sniper attacks, she said in an interview. She said, they also occurred due to a scarcity of medical supplies and medical treatment, and most distressingly, due to inadequate access to food and drinking water, forcing consumption of contaminated or polluted water. At least 1,755 Palestinians have been killed in the Gaza Strip since the International Court of Justice issued its order. The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has said Israel has an unwavering commitment to international law and to its sacred commitment to continue to defend our country and defend our people. He has described the International Court of Justice case as a vile attempt to deny Israel this fundamental right. Lawyers have argued that the extent of Israel's compliance with the orders is a test not only of the top United Nations Court's authority, but of other signatories to the Genocide Convention. Youssef Al-Tamimi, a visiting fellow at New York University School of Law, pointed out that the International Court of Justice case law, notably the Bosnia versus Serbia ruling in 1996, specifies that states have the responsibility to employ all means reasonably available to them so as to prevent genocide so far as possible. He said that applied equally to states with the capacity to influence effectively the action of persons likely to commit or already committing genocide. In the Serbia judgment, the International Court of Justice found a state bore responsibility if it was aware or should normally have been aware of the serious danger that acts of genocide would be committed. This places stricter obligations on states that provide financial, intelligence and military assistance to Israel's campaign in Gaza, he said. South Africa's lawyers intend to press further over Israeli compliance with the ICJ's orders and third parties over their obligations. The case accusing the Israeli regime of genocide was brought by South Africa, but others have since taken action. Nicaragua, for example, has asked to join the case on the basis it says that Israel is breaching the convention, and Algeria, the current lead Arab nation and on the UN Security Council, has tabled a resolution endorsing the ICJ's orders and adding that a humanitarian ceasefire is a prerequisite for them to be implemented. Iran's Press TV has also covered the same story. The Israeli regime Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has ordered Israeli military to prepare a plan to evacuate Palestinian civilians from Gaza's Rafah ahead of an expected invasion of the densely populated southern city in Gaza, despite warnings that such a move would be an absolute disaster. On Friday, 9th of February, Netanyahu's office said he had ordered the military to come up with a combined plan that includes both a massive evacuation of civilians and attacks on Palestinian resistance fighters in Rafah in southern Gaza. The statement by Netanyahu's office said it is impossible to achieve the goal of the war of eliminating Hamas by leaving four Hamas battalions in Rafah. On the contrary, it is clear that intense activity in Rafah requires that civilians evacuate the area of combat. The evacuation orders are seen as part of Israeli regime propaganda. At the start of the aggression on Gaza, the Israeli regime ordered 1.1 million people in northern Gaza to evacuate their homes and move south to the coastal sliver to Rafah. In southern Gaza, however, it has continued to rain down bombs in southern Gaza as well. It also remains unclear where civilians can go, as Israel's genocidal war on Gaza that began on 7th of October has caused widespread destruction, especially in northern Gaza. Netanyahu's order came in defiance of heavy international criticism, including from Israel's chief ally, the United States, of Israeli intentions to invade Rafah that borders Egypt and is now home to hundreds of thousands of Palestinian refugees who have been displaced from their homes. Also, the U.S. State Department has warned that an invasion of Rafah in the current circumstances would be a disaster. Israel has already begun to strike Rafah from the air since overnight. Aid agency officials have also warned against any invasion of Rafah in southern Gaza. We need Gaza's last remaining hospitals, shelters, markets and water systems to stay functional, said Catherine Russell, the head of the United Nations Children's Agency, UNICEF. Catherine Russell added, without them, hunger and disease will skyrocket in Gaza, taking more lives of Gaza's children. Meanwhile, Iran has warned the United States against its continued support for the Israeli regime. The Iranian Foreign Minister, Hossein Amir Abdollahian, says such unqualified support by the United States will have no result but absolute defeat. The Zionist regime of Israel seeks to drown the United States in the quagmire of war in West Asia, Hossein Amir Abdollahian said during a press conference. He was speaking upon arrival in the Lebanese capital, Beirut, on Friday, 9th of February. Since the beginning of hostilities in Gaza on 7th of October, the Islamic Republic of Iran has maintained that war is not a solution to the Palestinian issue. And the Iranian Foreign Minister, Hossein Amir Abdollahian, emphasized that fact. Amir Abdollahian said Israel has failed to achieve any of its goals in Gaza thanks to the Palestinian resistance, as well as the Lebanese resistance and the resistance of the entire West Asia region. The Palestinian and Lebanese resistance leaders, he said, have displayed a tactfully wise attitude in action and politics. And Abdullahian said, today we see the Victorian Palestinian resistance has put a political plan in the name of Hamas on the table. The Iranian Foreign Minister commended the effective role of the Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah in the face of the Israeli regime and paid tribute to all the martyrs of the Palestinian and Lebanese resistance fronts.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he is so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم our greetings and salams and respect and salutations, first of all, to the Imam of our time, Imam Mahdi, Ajjalallah Ta'ala Farajul Sharif, and to you, dear brothers and sisters, who are listening to another episode of the program, Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we try to delve a little bit deeper into challenges and problems that you, dear parents, Muslim parents, might have with regards to raising your lovely, dear teenagers. And alhamdulillah, in the studio, we have our dear guest, an expert of the program, Sayyid Salman Naghawi, who is a faculty member of Al-Mustafa University. His specialty is Islamic studies. Assalamu alaikum. Welcome.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
Okay, so we've been dealing with the issue of hard children that who are very, you know, challenging. You know, you lose your temper with them. You work so many hard, long hours to provide for them, to meet their needs, their financial needs, their material needs. And after all, you're a human being yourself. And it's really hard sometimes to have someone who, you know, and especially children and teenagers these years, that their expectations are so high and they are not thankful. You provide a lot for them, and at the end of the day, they say, I never asked for it, you did it yourself. So, I mean, a lot of we parents do see these things from our children. So in this program, Sayyid Naghawi is going to share with us 7 ways to tackle, you know, these children and to establish a very fruitful, communicative relationship with your teenager. Is that right?
Yes, there's a, for that communication, assertive communication that we were saying, you need to keep your temper, don't lose your temper. But there are 7 steps to that. I mean, as an advice, as you said, that we can seek advice from people who know.
So the points that you're telling us, are they based on Islamic teachings or psychological
teachings? I mean,
basically,
when we talk about Islamic teachings, many of them, as we say, are irshadi. They guide us towards what other people, many different experts may understand for themselves. Because sometimes the teachings in Islam are based on some of the human experiences. I mean, whatever human experience as a result of advancement of the human knowledge and wisdom.
You mean experimental sciences?
Even philosophical issues and experimental issues, all of them go, whatever the treasure of human knowledge is that we have today, much of it is endorsed by Islam and its teachings. I mean, many of the things that Islam told us, we could have, at that time, maybe it was not easy for us to discuss them. Today, we realize that many of the things that were there in the treasure of Islamic teachings is something which human beings can discover, but it will take time.
Right.
So now we need to, you know, we find that all of these things are embedded in Islamic teachings. I mean, when you talk about, when we're going to say here that you need to let your teenager know that you demand respect, you want him to respect you, you respect yourself, something which Islam teaches us, human dignity. So you need to show that we are dignified, we, both of us are dignified human beings. Human beings are dignified. And dignity has to be respected, dignity has to be maintained. This is what Islam is telling us. So in the same way,
I just remembered the story where the parent brought their child to the Prophet so that he would, I don't know, name the child or say azan, and the child urinated on the Prophet, and the parents got so angry at that little child, and the Prophet said, no, keep your calm, and I can easily wipe out or wash out this dirty clothes of mine, but the scar that you will leave on the personality or character of your child will never be removed. So this means takrim, or honoring or respecting your child, that starts from much, much before the child is born, and it continues all along until they turn into
exactly.
adults.
So basically, human beings, Islam has come to establish and promote the dignity of mankind, isn't it? So it is basically... Karramna bani Adam. So if we want to teach our children to be dignified, they need to respect me as a human being also, not for my sake, because Allah has made me a human being. And the child should know that I'm a human being and he is a human being. And that equality has to be maintained. I respect him, he respects me.
Right. Let's go for a short break and we'll be right back.
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam said, honor your children and teach them good manners.
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات
Welcome back, dear brothers and sisters. We're talking about the fact that one of the ways to establish a good connection with your child is to honor them, to respect them in practice.
And to teach them to respect yourself also, yeah. Both ways. It should be, number one, respect, setting the boundaries to show this is how you respect me, mm-hmm. and show him how to respect yourself.
Do you believe that... some psychologists these days say that if others don't respect you, sometimes it's because you don't respect yourself.
Exactly. That's true.
The tricky point.
That is a tricky. Not allowed to backbite someone behind his back, speak bad of him behind his back. It's also wrong to be such a person that people talk about you and lift fingers at you, and they make you try to dishonor you. You have to maintain your honor, your dignity, yourself. If you are causing people to go behind your back and talk about you in a negative way,
you're to be blamed.
We are ourselves to be blamed. So we need to maintain that dignity in any case, our own dignity and the dignity of our children. And this should be, number two, based on an equal footing. And number three, so number one, dignity. Number two, equality in this dignity. Neither I yell at him or shout at my child, nor does he yell it back at me. We both have to be polite and kind to each other and love each other. But I have to take the lead. I have to show the way. Number three, whatever we say, don't beat behind the bush. Directly. Mm-hmm. Communicate what you want, what your request is, what you expect from your child.
But at the right time, not when he's angry, true. Hungry, tired.
True, very true. And then you should remain very much focused on what you're saying. Don't, go this way and that way. Whatever you want, be focused on it. And keep the doors open for negotiations. Maybe he comes back and says, oh, I don't accept what you're saying. I don't want to do what you're saying. Okay, let's leave it for another day. Let's come back again. If he says or she says, I'm not going to accept what you're saying, then you say, then get lost.
I say, you have to clean your room. I have this problem with my own daughter. Clean your room. For example, she promises to do it, but she never does it. Or she says, I don't want to do it. So
she's a teenager.
Right.
If she's a teenager, then assert yourself and say, no, this has to be done.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have to try again and again to make that and, enforce that. And you need to, that negotiation, you shouldn't break up all your communications. And stop and lose hope in it. No, you need to start again sometime.
Right. Let's go for a short break and we'll be right back.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, my dear brothers and sisters in faith. We're talking about seven steps that you should take in order to make right the relationship or the communication that you have with your teenager. How many points have you mentioned so far?
Number one, value yourself, dignity, mm-hmm. maintain your dignity. Number two, promote that in an equal way, on an equal footing between yourself and your child. You should respect him and he should respect you.
Mutual respect.
Mutual. Number three, whatever you want to say, it should be directly mentioned.
Don't beat around the bush.
Number four, it should be focused on one thing that you want to enforce.
Mm-hmm.
And then if there's a pushback, there's some problem, don't let the communication break down. Then you should always maintain that position of calmness. And maintain your cool and say, okay, we'll talk about it another day. But you have to come back to it again to reinforce that. And then you also, when you set a rule and when you set a boundary, you need to also show them, tell them what the consequences will be and follow through with those consequences. For example, you say, oh, if you don't do this, then I will not take you out for a walk, I will not take you out for a movie or whatever reward you wanted to give, mm-hmm. you deprive the child of that reward. Something for breakfast, I will only give you what you want for breakfast if you do this,
mm-hmm.
if you tidy your room, if you whatever. And then if the child is doing what you have asked, then you should praise him or her.
Reward the good job.
Praise is also important. Praise, not praise. Only rewarding, but also praising.
Praise the person.
And if you don't, things didn't work out as they were planned, then again, you should come back again and say, okay, no problem, we weren't successful this time, let's try again.
Mm-hmm.
So even in case what you expected did not work out, then you need to come back and, you know, try again.
You know, perhaps sometimes some tasks are seen very unmanageable to the child, or it's like the child thinks it's a very hard, difficult thing to do. So you can break it into different pieces and say, okay, so today you can do this part. For example, if it's with regards to cleaning the room, you can, for example, make the bed,
exactly.
and I will help you to put your dirty laundry away. Or, you know, you can offer help, and little by little you can establish that good trait in them by breaking that big one single whole task into different segments or dimensions, and let the child, you know, it's the same way where when we adults have to do something something and we keep postponing it because we think, oh, it's too hard, I'm not going to, you know, you just, you feel it's too difficult to be handled, so you just keep postponing it. But they say, break it down. Just take, for example, just do 5 minutes of the work today, do 10 minutes tomorrow. Once you break it, ultimately, gradually, you'll have the work done.
That's a good way, exactly. That should be the case, and we should be teaching ourselves, educating ourselves and our children. But we need to help. We need to make them to sort the issues themselves. They need to face the challenges. They need to. You need to give them the chance to solve their problems themselves.
Thank you so much. This is the end of another episode of the program Islamic Upbringing. I'm sure a lot of you have a lot of questions to ask, or you have concerns or comments with regards to our program. Feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. You can also visit our social media, Instagram and Facebook, at Call of Islam Radio. And you can listen to our programs at parstoday.ir. وآخر دعوانا أن الحمد لله رب العالمين.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space returned upon rest.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 31 meters. 9,650 kHz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.